nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Bob Boyd. I've always said of Rochester, but actually he has some new credentials here. So he'll tell you a little bit about his move to Ottawa. But his background, he was an undergrad at MIT, graduated in 1969, received his PhD in physics from Berkeley in 1977, and he worked with Charles Townes, and he was doing some of the first work on using nonlinear optics for astrophysics applications. Joined the Institute of Optics in 1977 at Rochester, where he's the M. Parker Givens Professor of Optics. And in 2009, he was the recipient of the Willis E. Lamb Award for Laser Science and Quantum Optics. And so today, he'll tell us about a half century of nonlinear optics.
Okay, so thank you for the introduction. Thank you for inviting me to be here. I have to tell you, it almost hurts to give a talk like this, because when you give a colloquium, you want to tell about yourself. And today, I'm going to be talking about other people's work. As you know, the laser is 50 years old. The history of nonlinear optics is not exactly the same as the history of the laser, but almost. First laser, 1960. First nonlinear optics experiment, 1961. Every time there is an advance in how well lasers work, there was an advance in how well nonlinear optics work. So the year 2010 was the 50th anniversary of the laser. The year 2011 is the 50th anniversary of the field of nonlinear optics. I guess that for those of you who know me, what might be surprising is that that says University of Ottawa. So the Canadian government under Stephen Harper 2 years ago decided that they wanted to make a major investment in academic research. And they had an international competition to attract people, and I applied, and they made me a position. So, as I tell my Canadian colleagues, I hate to be crass, but I am American, so I'll be crass. They offered me $25 million, and it's not so much that you want to leave your own country, it's not so much you want to leave the University of Rochester, and it's not even that I'm being crass. It's not the $25 million, it's what you might hope to be able to do with $25 million. So they want me to put together a research establishment. There's three faculty lines in addition to myself. So graduate students, if you're looking for postdoctoral positions, please let me know. If there are undergraduates here and you want this broadening experience of a PhD from outside of your own country, This is as minimal as you can be in that being your own country.
I feel like it's here.
Yeah. It's a four. We hear a traditional American voice speaking to us, don't we? Okay. Okay. So anyway, those were the introductory remarks. Okay. So here's a brief outline. Go talk about what is nonlinear optics. Then how are optical nonlinearities different from others? This is a physics colloquium. That you're not all optics people. So I don't know if I need to say it, but I'll tell you why optics is just so exciting that some of us really do this. Then give the history of nonlinear optics, and then in what time remains, tell you about some of my own research interests. Okay, so I guess the fundamental nonlinear optical interaction is what we would call light-by-light scattering. For those of you who are high-energy physicists, this is what I do for a living. In fact, in all honesty, a high-energy theorist came up to me about 6 months ago and said, finally, I know what you people do. Okay, so I think most of us don't really think of don't think in these terms, but this is a Dilbert diagram, which two photons enter and they scatter off each other and two photons leave. This process has actually never been observed in vacuum. but I can observe it anytime I want to in my own laboratory. If I don't do it in vacuum, but if I put some nonlinear optical material here, so some video projectors do better than others, but here we have two laser beams intersecting in a nonlinear optical material. And if you look, if you have good imagination, you will see four beams leaving. So these two beams interfere inside the nonlinear optical material and create a modulation of the refractive index. They form a grating, and each one of the two input beams scatters off, and you get four output beams. In a certain sense, this is what we would call an AND gate, because you would get light in this output direction only if both input beams are present. This is not the engineering version of an off-photonic switch, but I think this serves to establish why the field of nonlinear optics has relevance to the field of photonics and photonic switching. We are never beyond plugging our own books, right? So this is my nonlinear optics book. It's now in the third edition. What I will tell you, you will either make you very happy or very unhappy, or you won't care. But it is now in the SI system of units. First two editions were in the Gaussian system, which God had intended. I have gone over to the dark side of the force. Now, for those of you who don't want to shell out the money to buy my book, I have a one-page Cliff's Note version of my book. The pathetic truth is that if you understand this, you will understand everything you need to go to talks on nonlinear optics and know what people are talking about. So the simplest way of understanding nonlinear phenomena is to ask, how does a material respond to an applied laser field? And it responds by developing a polarization, which is a dipole moment per unit volume. And the simplest thing we could do is to expand. This one has a dead man switch. I have to use both hands on it, but it does work. We can expand the polarization in a power series expansion. I'll call these chi 1, chi 2, chi 3 effects. And chi 1 effects are just the linear response. Chi 2 effects are second order effects, such as second harmonic generation. Light at frequency omega enters a material. It gets converted to light at frequency 2 omega. And the third order interaction is, well, for example, the intensity-dependent refractive index. Essentially, all materials have the property that the measured value of the refractive index scales with the intensity of the light that you use to measure the refractive index. This coefficient is called M2. It can either be a positive number or a negative number, depending on the physical properties of the material at hand. Why do we love nonlinear optics? Or why do we hate nonlinear optics? Well, there are fundamental theories of the magnitude of the nonlinear optical response. You can start with Schrodinger's equation, and you can derive explicit formulas for the magnitude of the optical nonlinearity. There is a certain perverse sense of elegance in this result. I don't think it's realistic to think that you can evaluate it, because you'd have to know all the entire energy spectrum of the atom, all the dipole transition moments, all of the energy eigenvalues, but the thought that that in concept we can at the most fundamental level determine the size of optical nonlinearities makes the field intriguing. At another level, you can ask, what is the essence of nonlinear optics? And at in a certain sense, it's the concept of phase matching. Material matter is made up of a very large number of atoms. In the presence of a laser, let's say we're talking about some frequency generation. Light at frequency omega 1 and omega 2 illuminate the material. You're trying to generate light at the sum frequency. Now, because of the nonlinearity, each atom develops a dipole moment oscillating at the sum frequency. But of course, any dipole will radiate in a dipole emission pattern, which looks like this. However, if you have a very large number of atoms all oscillating in phase with one another, the emitted radiation can add up in the forward direction. This concept of phase matching is a very special feature of nonlinear optics. In microwave nonlinearities, if the wavelength becomes large compared to the dimensions of the sample, you wouldn't have this type of behavior. So optical phenomena are just perfectly well suited for studying these nonlinear behaviors. Okay, so with those very brief introductions, let me turn now to a brief history of the field of nonlinear optics. First, in terms of a timeline, including the prehistory, 58, Shallow and Townes proposed the concept of the optical maser. 1960, Maiman demonstrates the first working laser. 1961, Franken and co-workers describe the first clearly nonlinear optical process, second harmonic generation. 1962, Bloembergen and his group develops a comprehensive theory of nonlinear optics. And then in the next several years, sort of the classic nonlinear optical interactions that we all know and love, well, those of you who do nonlinear optics, stimulated Raman scattering, stimulated Brillouin scattering, self-trapping of light were observed or proposed. I think what you notice here is how enormously compressed this earlier time scale was. So when the laser was invented, people said, you know, there's some really good physics we can do with this, and let's go out and see what the implications are. Okay, so now let me go into details, and I thank John Dudley very much for helping me to prepare these slides. I digress. John Dudley invited me to give a public talk on this at the European Optical Society meeting. He then got second thoughts that I would screw up and embarrass him, so he wrote the talk for me and sent it to me. So with more than a small amount of help from John Dudley, here is the early history of nonlinear optics. I said that the first experiment was this observation of second harmonic generation. A humorous anecdote here is that this is the fundamental light. This is a spectrogram. This is a ruby laser light. 6,900 nanometers. Second harmonic generation is at 3,500 nanometers. The copy editor at the journal said, "Ooh, there's a speck of dust there," and he raises it. So, and those of you who knew Peter Frank would know, he would have the arrogance to write a paper that shows the non-existence of what he had observed, although it really was there. And the journal editor removed it.
Said that is the original negative still in existence? Or
Who knows? And Peter passed away a few years ago. We all believe it. I mean, it's been repeated so many times. No one has ever doubted Peter's version of the story. So 1 year later, Bloembergen develops this theory of nonlinear optics. All these years later, it really is a classic. The notation gets messy at times, but that's an aside. To this day, occasionally, because I teach nonlinear optics, to this day, I occasionally think I've made a discovery. I discovered some subtle new attribute of nonlinear optics, and I always go back, and it's in this original paper of his. I mean, the thought that such a complete theory could be worked out in just a year or so time is really impressive. Of course, he does have a Nobel Prize. now, the rest of this, I think it's a much more personal thing. a lot has happened in nonlinear optics, and I'll just emphasize a few things that are of particular interest to me. And one of them is supercontinuum generation. I mean, it turns out that if you take a high-power picosecond laser, focus it into a liquid or a solid, it generates white light. And, of course, the world knows how this works. There are many theories of it. And there's some commonality among the theories. But I think even today people are, there are some disagreement as to exactly what the origin of white light generation is. John Dudley likes to call this an anti-laser. An optically pumped laser, you pump it with a flash lamp and you get out monochromatic light. Supercontinuum generation, you put in monochromatic light and you get out white light. So actually, what is going on? Well, probably it's what's called self-phase modulation. A very short pulse of light will change the refractive index in a time-varying fashion. This will put a time-varying phase onto the laser beam, and a time-varying phase is a frequency shift. But there's some indication that Raman scattering can help drive this along and make it more efficient than just the self-phase modulation would on its own. I guess a crucial development is fiber optics. You don't need optical fibers to do nonlinear optics, but optical nonlinearities become much more intense, much more prominent in optical fibers. And the reason is because the fibers are long. So nonlinear optical effects can be cumulative. If you focus a laser beam into a chunk of glass, the nonlinear effect will build up over the focal region of the laser beam. But in an optical fiber, the light is contained to a small diameter over very large distances. So one can routinely see nonlinear optical effects in an optical fiber using maybe tens of milliwatts of laser power, as opposed to maybe tens of watts or kilowatts for bulk matter. So here are some examples of fiber nonlinear optics. People have measured both Brillouin scattering and Raman scattering in optical fibers. There's the Kerr effect leading to self-phase modulation, which I've mentioned already. If you send a narrow bandwidth pulse of light into an optical fiber, what comes out the other end is a broadened spectrum, and the various components can beat together to lead to an output spectrum that looks like this. Roger Stolen has pursued this thought. It turns out that this is one of the best ways of measuring the nonlinear coefficient of an optical fiber. You count how many bumps there are here. The number of bumps is pi times the nonlinear phase shift in radians. So if you go through the analysis. It's just a very, very simple way, at least to within a factor of two, to measure the nonlinear coefficient of optical materials. Another dramatic nonlinear optical effect is the concept of the soliton. In the context of optics, it was Hasegawa and Tappert who first talked about this, first observed in the laboratory by Molenauer and his group. But what do people mean by a soliton in this context? If you send a short pulse of light into an optical fiber, you would expect the spectrum to broaden due to self-phase modulation. In addition, you would expect the pulse to broaden in time, because a short pulse of light necessarily has a very broad spectrum. Different frequency components propagate with a different velocity. So a short pulse of light will turn into a broad pulse of light. If you were clever, you could find a material in which those two effects had equal magnitude and opposite sign, and self-phase modulation would precisely cancel the effect of dispersion in the velocity of the pulse. And that is what people mean by an optical soliton. This has played a very important role in the history of optical telecommunication. At one time, people were proposing that you could send pulses for very long distances by launching solitons. My understanding is that this is not the baseline approach anymore, but the understanding of optical solitons has been very important, both as at the conceptual level and for the possible practical level. Now, there's another type of optical soliton, which is called spatial soliton. Beams of light tend to diffract. On the other hand, an optical nonlinearity could make a beam to collapse on itself. If this N2 parameter is positive, then even a plane parallel piece of material will have a lensing effect, because the refractive index will be larger at the center of the beam than at the edges of the beam. So a slab of glass will act like a lens. If you do things just right, you can once again find a situation in which the tendency of the beam to spread due to diffraction is countered by the tendency to compress due to self-focusing effects. And that is known as a spatial soliton, and these effects have been observed in the laboratory as well. But are solitons intrinsically important? Well, it turns out that there is an intimate connection between solitons and the tendency of lasers to spontaneously form very short pulses. These are called mode-locked lasers. The various modes of the lasers develop a fixed phase relationship, and the laser tends to produce a train of very short pulses of light. The physics of how this works can be understood in terms of the laser choosing to emit light in the form of solitons. And, well, the Bell Labs group, and in fact, in some of this work, Herman House contributed. I guess he's not here. So one can actually work out the details of how lasers will tend to form soliton-like output pulses. What about spatial solitons? Well, in fact, this is Wilson Sibbett and his co-workers have found that the European spelling. We know that somebody has crept in. So the Canadians are funny. They just half the time they do American half. Wilson Sibbett made this remarkable discovery, which some of you maybe know about. You buy a titanium sapphire laser, and if it's running continuous wave, you walk over the laser and you bang on the table, and it suddenly starts mode locking. This must be so frustrating to the old timers. I mean, Tony DeMaria spent years developing mode lock lasers. Wilson Sibbett says, now you just bang on your table with your shoe and it'll do it. So what's happening here? So let's imagine that you put an aperture inside the laser cavity. If the laser intensity is low, then let's say the beam diameter would be this much, and it's a highly lossy system. If the laser intensity goes up, the beam will tend to self-focus a little bit in going through the material. The beam diameter shrinks, and more of the light goes through this aperture. So one finds it difficult to be anthropomorphic, but the laser knows that if it decides to emit a series of pulses instead of continuous wave, that it can generate more light. And nature loves optics. So the system, the noise that drives the system pushes the system in a way that the system will form high peak power, short pulses, in other words, so that more of the light can be transmitted through this limiting aperture. Oh, that's just so pretty. But actually, if you send a very short pulse of light through an optical fiber, you can find that these nonlinear optical processes will make the color of the light change as a function of distance along the fiber. This becomes particularly this process of white light generation, or supercontinuum generation, which I've mentioned already, going back to 1968. If you take a highly structured fiber, known as a photonic crystal fiber, I'm not sure this shows out, but this this is not a solid core fiber. It's a honeycomb structure. If you send light through a honeycomb structure, the light will tend to be concentrated in these very small regions where the glass is present. You get an even more spectacular super broadening effect. And this is results of Jinendra Ranka showing that in this particular case, the input spectrum at 800 nanometers has broadened by so that it extends for more than one octave. So you say to yourself, is that important? It's curious, but is that important? Well, many of you in the room know the answer. You say, could I turn that into something important? Is this useful? Could I patent it? Could I win a Nobel Prize from this idea? So in fact, I think Ted Hensch, before he won his Nobel Prize, used to send this around all the time, just so we didn't forget that it was his idea, that you could use this supercontinuum generation to build optical frequency combs and be able to do very precise metrology based on this concept. And to make a long story short, if the frequency comb extends over at least one octave, then you can use nonlinear optics to form the second harmonic of the low frequency part of this pulse, beat it in a detector with the high frequency part of the pulse, measure that beat note. On the basis of that beat note, you now can determine in an absolute sense what the frequency of each one of these is. Of course, you always knew the separation between the various teeth of this comb, because the separation depends on the length of the cavity. Modes are separated by C over 2L. But what you don't know is how this comb is displaced along the time axis. But once you do know, once you do have an octave spanning frequency, you can then make an absolute determination of the frequency of the teeth on this comb. And of course, the Nobel Prize was awarded in 2005. Well, Roy Glauber for fundamental contributions to quantum optical coherence theory, but Jan Hall and Ted Hensch for actually implementing this idea.
of stable clocks based on frequency combs. Another aspect of nonlinear optics is very high field physics. I guess I started off this talk by saying, let's do a power series expansion of the polarization in the field strength. That is a perturbative approach. Perturbation theory corresponds to the various terms in that. But there's a whole other limit of nonlinear optics in which your pulses have enough energy and are sufficiently short that the electric field strength becomes larger than the electric field strength at the position of an electron inside an atom. Or, in other words, that the laser field is much stronger than the strength of the field that binds the electron to the core of the atom. In this case, the laser field can simply rip electrons off of the atom. It can do it in a half optical cycle. This is not the thermal breakdown that we usually think about when we call them the idiot graduate student. When the idiot graduate student burns a hole in your really, really, really expensive optical component by focusing into it instead of in front of it. I mean, it's very complicated, but it's thermally induced. This is something entirely different. It's where you just rip an electron off of an atom. So my colleague at Ottawa, Paul Corkum, is one of the world leaders in this. People call this above threshold ionization because usually you don't think of ripping more than one electron off of an atom. They also call it high harmonic generation because you can get, well, I talked about second harmonic generation or third harmonic generation. But they routinely get up to the 201st harmonic. Has to be an odd number. And so, Paul Corkum says, Robert, you are living in the 20th century. We do this with molecules now. And with molecules, because a molecule does not have to have inversion symmetry, he's now doing it with even harmonics. So, say, traditionally, it was only the odd harmonics that you could produce just because of symmetry considerations. Okay, so now, do I have time left? I do. Yeah, I do, because I really want to tell you what I do. So in whatever time is left, I just want to tell you about some of the things, and if I don't get through, that's okay. I just want to now give you a few tidbits of the sorts of things that I'm interested in working on myself. Okay, so one of the things I've been working on, and that many others as well, is slow and fast light. So over the past 10 years or so, the nonlinear optics community has learned how to dramatically modify the group velocity of light. Let me remind you that the group velocity is the velocity at which the peak of a pulse moves through a material. We can represent the group velocity in terms of the group index, where the group index is the usual refractive index plus omega times dn d omega. So in a highly dispersive material, you can find situations in which the group velocity is dramatically different from the phase velocity. We can slow light down by a factor as much as a million. We can make it go faster than the speed of light in vacuum, and we can even make it go negative. And this involves some intriguing intellectual thought, and moreover, there are some applications that I think are very exciting that can be produced by making use of the ability to control the velocity of light. In broad scope, there are two ways of controlling the group velocity. One is to use material slow light. I mean, here you find a homogeneous material that has a strong resonance, either in the linear response, or perhaps more intriguingly, you can find a nonlinear optical mechanism that can produce a resonance at the frequency you want. There's another way, which is called structural slow light, intimately related to metamaterials. But I think the terms have developed so that we mean different things now. So structural slow light, for example, a photonic crystal. In a photonic crystal, if you work right at the edge of the Brillouin zone, you can find situations in which the light is dramatically slowed down. And for those of us, and don't we all, for those of us who love freshman physics explanation of things, it's because strong Umlaut processes, instead of the light going straight through, the light keeps bouncing back and forth. It has an overall forward motion, but because you're right at the edge of the Brillouin zone, it also is suffering repeated back and forward scattering. Both of these techniques are very, very useful. I guess if you want to build devices, you might want to do it this way. If you want to understand the physics better, maybe you want to do it this way. Okay, in broad scope, how does slow light work? If you have an absorption, you always have a swing in the refractive index that looks like this from Kramers-Kronig relations. Rule is take this, differentiate it, add it to itself. Here's what you find. So the group index tends to go negative on resonance, swings positive away from resonance. So for an absorption resonance, you get fast light at line center, slow light in the wings of the line. For a gain resonance, it's which is the opposite. You go through Kramers-Kronig relations, this curve is flipped over, you get slow light on line center, fast light in the wings of the line.
How fast is fast?
Anywhere from C to infinity. Now, there's a semantic question of whether you call negative fast. Well, we'll get to that. It's unbounded. But a negative velocity, in a sense, is even faster than an infinite velocity. Okay, so, of course, using nonlinear optics, you can create a dip in a gain feature or a dip in an absorption feature. Now, just slowing down the speed of light is not very useful. Being able to control the group velocity of light is useful. So nonlinear optics, I think, plays a crucial role here. If you want to slow down a pulse of light, why don't you use a very long optical fiber? What you want to do is to find situations in which you can control the velocity of light in an active manner. And both slow and fast light are possible here as well. As maybe many of you know, what really got this field jump-started was this paper of Lena Howe, Steve Harris, and Lena's students, in which they showed that they could slow the velocity of light down to 17 meters per second. They point out on the cover of Nature that a good athlete can pedal a bicycle faster than that. But as a conceptual point, all of our lives, we thought that light went fast. We can be quantitative. But we all our lives, we thought that light traveled fast. This is sort of a, made people start thinking, well, you know, you can slow it down. And maybe we don't need to go through the details here. But in this work, they were using anatomic sodium vapor. They were using what's called electromagnetically induced transparency. They were able to produce a very narrow transparency window in the middle of what would otherwise be a very broad absorption line. And then according to Kramers-Kronig relations, the refractive index took on this wild swing, and the very rapid positive dN d omega here is what led to the very strong slow light effect. Now, I read Lena's paper. I said, isn't that incredible? Isn't that fun? Don't I want to do this? There was just enough of the engineer in me that I said, maybe a Bose-Einstein condensate is not the material system of choice for photonic structures, for if you want to do something useful with this. So what I started working on is, can we do slow light in a room temperature solid state material? And the answer is yes. And well, there's no time for the details, but we found two preferred mechanisms: stimulated Brillouin scattering and coherent population oscillations for doing this. I mean, one of the really dramatic demonstrations that we were able to do in my group was to actually do an experiment to show that this prediction of backwards pulse propagation is observable. So here is the conceptual prediction. Well, should give credit where credit is due. Ray Chow really made, was the person who told the world that backwards propagation of light is something that one could actually observe in a physically realistic manner. What we did was to do the experiment, but here's the prediction. Pulse of light is incident upon a material with a negative group index, and what happens is that the peak of the exiting pulse leaves before the peak of the entering pulse enters. An additional pulse is formed inside the material that propagates backwards and eventually annihilates with the input pulse. So what does backwards pulse propagation mean? Well, it means that the inside the material, the pulse really does move backwards, and that the exiting pulse the peak of the pulse that exits before the peak of the pulse that entered. I'm not violating causality. So it's very, very wrong to say that the pulse leaves before it enters. What's really going on? It's a quite remarkable form of pulse distortion. The pulse distorts in such a way that it looks as if the pulse exited before it left. How is this even possible? How is this even plausibly consistent with the concept of causality? Well, these are Gaussian pulses. And a Gaussian pulse goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So no matter what it looks to you by eye, this pulse is already here. So there is no concept of causality violation. I think you'll notice that the experiment worked. The effect is not as dramatic in the laboratory as it is here. And for the experts in the room, these really are numerical simulations, but we turned off group velocity dispersion in these simulations here. Regrettably, in my laboratory, I do not have a knob that says turn off competing effects. So in the laboratory, we took everything, but in the simulation, we did not include this.
This is the actual process of Gaussian. Where was the semaphore precursor? In that picture, where was the semaphore precursor be?
Under these conditions, it's many, many orders of magnitude too weak to be seen. That's first answer. Second of all, do you mean where is it here or where is it here? If you believe me when I said these were Gaussians, there is no Brillouin precursor because the Gaussian goes from plus infinity to minus infinity. Regrettably, I didn't have enough time on my hands to make a pulse that went from time plus infinity to minus infinity. But we do go far enough that the turn on time. What is the Brillouin precursor? That's what the rest of you should be asking. The Brillouin precursor is the fact that there is a turn on of the pulse. And it's the turn on of that pulse will propagate at the vacuum speed of light no matter what. Okay, so it under these conditions, it was just too weak to be seen. And we are close to being out of time. Okay, so but how would we understand this from the point of view of causality? Well, there's a way of thinking about these things, which is that information is carried by points of non-analyticity on a waveform. So if you have a pulse amplitude that is a continuous function of time, then you can always predict the future behavior by performing a power series expansion and extrapolating into the future. The modern concept of information is that the way you impress information onto an optical pulse is at points of non-analyticity, because you cannot extrapolate through points of non-analyticity. And I'm pretty sure that Ray is not the first person to have said this, but he is the person who has really pushed this interpretation forward. Let me just end up here. So, is this useful? So, here's just one very simple example. Let's say you're building a telecommunication system, but there's jitter. I mean, life is not perfect, fibers aren't perfect, amplifiers are not perfect. You want the pulse to be centered in its time window, but because of jitter, perhaps after propagating through many tens of kilometers, it's no longer centered in the window. If you use slow light, you can move the pulse backwards. If you use fast light methods, you can move the pulse forward. Here we show a method that in the same physical system, we can get either slow light or fast light, allowing us to move the pulse either forward or backwards. And I think I'll end up with this example here. Interferometry and slow light. Question: would it be interesting, would it be useful to take a slow light material and place it inside of an interferometer? And I guess I always thought, no, that wouldn't be very interesting, because interferometers work on phase, and why should the interferometer depend on anything other than the phase velocity? But then I went through the analysis. So let's say you build an interferometer and you put a slow light material in one arm, and you ask yourself, what comes out here as I change, say, the wavelength of the light that goes in? So what is the question I'm asking? It's how does the phase difference between this arm and this arm depend on the frequency of the light that I use? So what is d by d omega? And the phase acquired in going through the slow light medium is omega nL over C. And you differentiate this, and you find, either by accident or not, it's actually the group index that shows up. So it's actually the group index that determines the sensitivity of an interferometer. And, first thing we did was just take a plate of cadmium sulfide selenide in the form of a Fabry-Pérot-Edelon. And as a function of wavelength, as you approach the band edge, you get more and more dispersion in the refractive index, a bigger and bigger group index. And, we did an experiment here that showed that the resolution of our Edelon was about twice as large as it would have been if the material had a constant uniform value of the group index. So where is our work heading now? So this is consuming about half of my effort at this present. I want to build a chip scale slow light spectrometer. The idea is that we can enhance the resolution of a spectrometer by as much as the group index of the material inside the spectrometer. Group indices can be at least as large as a factor of a million. So what we want to do is to build a chip scale spectrometer, size at the very most a millimeter. that would have the same spectral resolution as a 1 meter grating spectrometer. And we want to use this to do chemical sensing, for example, to oppose terrorism threats, but by having a very simple, small way of doing spectrochemical analysis. So how will we get our slow light material? So we are going to fabricate a photonic crystal by the, photonic crystals can have a very large slow light effect when you're right at the edge of the photonic band gap. I think I mentioned that already. It turns out that if you, instead of having a perfect photonic crystal, if you tweak it a little bit, and instead of having these holes on a perfectly periodic array, you move them around a little bit, you can find that you can make the group index fairly constant over a reasonably large spectral region. There are a lot of geometries that we are thinking of using, but sort of our baseline approach right now is to build what's called an arrayed waveguide grating. It's used commonly in telecommunication for wavelength division multiplexing. People usually just put ordinary optical fibers or waveguides here. We are going to put slow light waveguides here and attempt to increase the dispersion of this device by many, many fold. So I think the talk doesn't really end. It just ran out of time. So thank you very much for your attention. I'm going to pause here. It looks like my glasses, yes. So last week, someone said, I never understood, now I do. You do nonlinear optics, that's why you wear round eyeglasses. It's as good an answer as any, isn't it?
So there's actually a lot of velocities. There's velocity at which information travels, energy, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Phase. So you just talked about group. I mean, are there other velocities of interest?
I think the information velocity is the fundamental one. And it is now believed that the information velocity is C under all cases. So then why do we care? Well, because the world contains two types of people, physicists and engineers. I mean, they don't care that the group velocity, that the information velocity is always C, because if you don't have enough signal to noise ratio to make the measurement, then that doesn't matter at all. So the group velocity, except for highly, highly exotic situations, the group velocity is a very good, estimate of the energy velocity. And if you don't put enough energy on your detector, you're not going to make the measurement. I think Peter Maloney and others say that there's at least 7 different velocities. It's a physics department. What do you teach your freshmen? You teach them about the group velocity. No, I think that we have decided that the group velocity is a very important concept. It's the velocity at which the peak of the pulse moves. So from a practical point of view, it maybe is the rate at which the easily measurable information arises at the detector.
Sir, I have a question about the honeycomb
yes.
experiment. Is the significance of the experiment that a pulse laser is made up of infinite numbers of harmonic fields?
Good question. And like in class, if I ask the student and say, Professor, give me a little time to think about the answer to that question. Okay, so the fact that it was a photonic crystal fiber was sort of an issue of detail. The fact that it was a photonic crystal fiber gave it a much larger nonlinear response than you would otherwise have expected for a fiber of that length. The important issue was that you got this very broad comb of frequencies coming out, and that the teeth on the comb were exactly equally spaced. And that was the important property. Did I answer your question? Well, let's make no question. I tried very hard to answer your question. Sincerity was tied up in my answer.
Yeah, just on the same topic of the photonic crystal fiber in that experiment, the other key aspect is the microstructuring allows one to shift the dispersion properties. So the laser comes in a range of the fiber where the different frequencies to zeroth order go at the same velocity. And that was probably at least equally important to make that experiment.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Final question? Anyone? Oh, sorry.
So the last thing you mentioned you're doing right now, you have this small scale photonic crystal enhance the spectroscopy. So this is general, applicable to any sort of spectroscopy.
Any spectrometer based on interferometry.
Right.
So not all spectrometers are based on interference phenomena. I mean, the Fourier transform spectrometer, for example, is a spectrometer based on interference effects. So certainly a Fourier transform spectrometer would be an example. Fabry-Perot etalon is another example. So anytime you build a spectrometer based on interference effects.
And that becomes a million factor enhancement just limited by the material?
Oh, other people, no, I just pulled a million out of the hat. A million's easy to get. People have achieved 10 to the eighth. I mean, people talk about snail speeds. So if Lena Howe can make light go the speed of a bicycle, someone else then wants light to go the speed of a snail. And of course, the question then is, what is the bandwidth over which you do this? So usually the more and more you increase the group index, the smaller the bandwidth. In the example of the spectrometer I'm trying to build, it was a trade-off between getting the largest possible group index and still having a bandwidth that's large enough that you could hope to do useful spectroscopy over that spectral region.
Okay, let's thank Bob again.